Welcome to Regenerative Spaces, a podcast that explores holistic and sustainable paths toward thriving in the fields of agriculture, education, spirituality, and beyond. Hey there, and welcome to Regenerative Spaces. I'm your host, Stacy Pellice. I'm a regenerative farmer in Santa Barbara, California, but my background and interests span a much broader range of fields, from psychology to spirituality and beyond. In my 3+ decades as an environmental activist, author, and educator, I've gotten increasingly curious about the links between the various ecosystems humans occupy. On this podcast, I'm inviting you to get curious with me. These episodes feature approachable conversations with inspiring experts in different disciplines, from intuitive healers, nonprofit founders, activists, and educators. We'll cover county politics, cattle ranching, and a whole world of other specialties in between. These folks are all at the forefront of their chosen fields, and each one offers a unique perspective on holistic, sustainable, and regenerative possibilities for our individual and collective lives. This week, I'm sharing my conversation with Linda Eckerbaum-Cole, founder and executive director of African Women Rising and a dear friend of mine. This community-based nonprofit organization has made a direct impact on the lives of over 150,000 refugees and war-affected women and their families in northern Uganda. You might recall African Women Rising from our episode in season one, where we discussed resilient agriculture with Linda's partners, Tom Cole and Warren Brush. Now, in season two, we're diving deeper. Join us as we explore Linda's story, the inner workings of African Women Rising, and the incredible women leading the charge to empower communities in Uganda. Well, let's dig in because I have so much curiosity and interest in your history and your path and what you do. I want to just start by saying how I met you. I met you in 2017. You were working with a high school media arts program and really helping them make little films based on photos and footage. And then my husband, Ron, and my son went with you to Uganda to go visit the work that you do at African Women Rising. So that was the beginning of my awareness. And at the same time, I met Tom Cole, your husband, and we started digging into permaculture and the work that he's been specializing in. And I've known you since and have been really learning year after year about how impactful and beautiful your work is. But it was really in 2022 where you had a new project that we're going to talk about later that I just fell all in, and I am so excited about everything. Now, it helped me learn more and feel the impact of what you do. So what I just wanted to start there. And could you let us know what African Women Rising basically is about before we dig a little deeper?
Absolutely. I started African Women Rising in 2006. And it's an organization that helped women and girls recover from experiencing conflict. So we provide the tools and the knowledge to move out of extreme poverty. And we run what is called the graduation model. So moving from extreme poverty is not something that happens overnight. It's a long process. So we start with microfinancing, providing access to capital. And the second piece is agriculture. Most of the people we work with are farmers. So it's looking at how can you increase your agricultural output with using sustainable methods and resources that you have around you. And then the third piece is education. We are the largest provider of adult literacy in northern Uganda. And this is the region where we work, northern Uganda. And we also work in 17 primary schools, making sure that girls complete primary school and then continue to secondary. So that's kind of in a nutshell what African Women Rising is about.
Mm-hmm. With the programming addresses. Yeah. That is very ambitious, and I know you have had brilliant results over the years. But I first want to go back and ask you, how did you get into this? I believe you're from Sweden, and now you live in Santa Barbara. And how did this happen? How did you get here?
I grew up in Sweden. My mother is Swedish. My father is Moroccan, but I definitely identify as being culturally Swedish. And I finished high school in Sweden. I was very much involved in theater. So my plan was to continue to go to theater school. And thankfully, I had a very good mentor who told me, look, you don't know anything about the world. You don't know anything about people. If you want to go into acting, you have to learn about life, about people, cultures. And I saw an ad in the paper about volunteering in Africa. And I figured, you know, that's as far away from anything that I know as possible. So I signed up for a one-year program and then I got stuck.
Yeah, that was in a different country, wasn't it?
I first worked in Guinea-Bissau in West Africa. And then I went to Angola and I was there during the war. And ended up eventually in Mozambique, where I spent 2 years, and that was also right after the war, building a vocational school.
Wow. So you went straight there to get your theater background and then ended up spending years at it.
Yeah, and now I haven't done any theater since.
I love
that. I completely changed my career path.
Yeah, but I bet it factors somehow. We'll find out how. And so then how did you end up transferring that into, so you're talking post-conflict, so civil war regions, and how did you end up then in Uganda?
So when I was in Mozambique, I met Tom, who's from Santa Barbara. And so that's how I ended up here. And so he does similar work. We spent a lot of time in countries doing humanitarian aid or development aid, and we're constantly seeing so many things that were wrong with it, that a lot of the aid were donor-driven, it was short-term, it was not based upon what people actually needed. So for years, we talked about, you know, if we could have our own organization, what would it look like? We ended up moving to Uganda. Tom got a job with Save the Children, and I wanted to be in a place where I could do research in a conflict area, but also, you know, have my kids with me. So we lived in the South where it was peaceful. I started doing consultancies for other organizations, and then it was like, okay, here's my chance to either we start this organization or it's never going to happen. So,
wow. So you were living there when you started this.
Absolutely.
I didn't realize that.
So we were in Uganda for almost 4 years. And so the first year that I was in Uganda, you know, I had all of these ideas of what I thought a good organization would look like and what we should be doing. And I've been doing this work long enough to realize that it was really important for me to get rid of all of those ideas and start to listen to people first. And so I spent almost a year traveling around in northern Uganda, talking to people living in at that point, people were living in IDP camps, so camps for internally displaced people. So I went into the camps, talked to women's groups, camp leaders. I got a list of all of the local organizations that were there to see if, you know, would it make more sense for us to help build up another organization? And so I just did a lot of listening. And so this is what we came up with.
Well, I'm struck by when we've talked or when I've heard you speak is how much it's what I learned in school to call participatory action research. So it's where it's different than the way we do other types of research sometimes. And this whole notion of a colonizing mindset where we know something, you and we'll help you. Could you talk a little bit about the differences in approaches to how aid can happen with other countries? Like, you're not technically African or Ugandan, and yet you're there making a huge difference. How is that different than some other models? Not that we're making them bad, but just how is that making you so effective?
Yeah. So the whole idea of African Women Rising is that the program is supposed to come from the people that we're working with. Mm-hmm. They know very well what they need to move forward. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I've never been hungry. Mm-hmm. I've never experienced conflict the way that these women have done. And so for me to come and provide them with solutions, that's kind of preposterous. So everything we do is based upon what the women themselves have said is important for them to move forward. And all of the staff we have, every single one except me, comes from the communities where we work. So they have a very clear understanding of what their communities needs. And wow. And many of them, you know, many of them were refugees themselves. They've lived in IDP camps. They've been hungry. They've gone through hunger periods. They have the lived experiences that, and that is what makes our work so successful.
That's powerful. Do you see that type of model happening very often? I mean, do we see that very often? I figure you must have your eye tuned a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a shift towards decolonizing development aid and humanitarian assistance, or especially development aid. But it's very difficult to actually implement. I mean, the whole idea is that we want to move power from offices in Europe and the US to the people who actually are on the ground. But it's a complicated process, and I don't see it very often. If I look at the model that we have, most organizations would not hire the staff that we have because they don't have a formal education.
Oh.
But they sure know what to do out in the field. You know, maybe their writing is not great, but they're very effective working in the field.
You know, it's interesting because when you were saying education, it made me think, did they get to decide what education looks like for them? And it may not look like what you think they should have. Is that true as well? Like, what does education look like? Does it look like how we do it here, or?
Oh, absolutely. So if you want to work for an organization, you need to have a university degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of people that I have on staff, our team, they do not have that.
But they're effective. What I'm saying, though, is that you're giving them education, though. You have educated them so that they have certain skills more than they would have had you not.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And so what I'm saying is African Women Rising helps educate them in ways that are effective for what they need. So they determine basically what education means. So it's self-directed in a way, even at that level.
And the skills that they have, that's what we need to make our programs effective.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Like we need someone, like when we talk about agriculture, we need someone who has the practical knowledge, right? Not the academic knowledge.
Right.
We need someone who can go out in the field, who can show this is how you double dig a vegetable bed and not just talk about it in theory.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Now, so women and girls, I have heard it said in a couple different ways, but in terms of, let's say, some of our hairiest problems, climate change, the most effective help you could give is. I've heard it said women and girls, and mm-hmm. I've heard Africa, because so it's like, what's that? Could you unpack that at all? Do you know why? Can you explain why women and girls are really so important globally?
Yes. And so there's a couple pieces to this, but first I want to start with that. It's always this, that, oh, women in Africa, they have so many children. And so there's overpopulation, oh. right? But so they use too many resources. But the amount of resources that someone, that a girl in a village in Africa is using compared to what you and I use every single day,
right.
is like, you know, you can't compare it. So one of the theories with this is, yes, if you educate women and girls, they have fewer children. So then there's, you know, less population.
Okay.
So I mean, so there's truth in that, but I don't like the narrative of like blaming girls in Africa who use far less. I mean, long term, if you look at men and girls who are educated, they are better able to make decisions for themselves. They have access to resources in a different way. They can start earning a better income. And they generally have smaller families. They have access to medical care. There's the whole this cycle or shift that happens when you educate women. And for us, I mean, that's a huge part of our programming. So we believe it's extremely important.
What's funny is I did not ever know that narrative. I'm going to tell you that. I'm never afraid to be ignorant. And there uh-huh. I am. I've heard the thing, and I've never heard, because women who aren't educated have more children. Well, guess what? Women don't have them alone. I mean, that makes it sound,
yeah.
it puts the onus on the children making on women, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
But also, I remember hearing that girls in these villages past a certain age aren't, I mean, there was like a few reasons why they're not encouraged to do education. Like, isn't there several barriers for girls to get educated?
Oh, absolutely. And that's where the girls' education program that we have is very effective on working on these issues. But so there's a couple of things that happen. And one, most of the parents that I talk to, when I ask them what they want for their future, they're saying, look, I want to educate my children. Mm. And they say they want to educate both their girls and their boys. Mm. So that's the starting point. But then there's all these barriers that make this really difficult. And one, of course, is poverty. If a family cannot afford to pay for school fees, mm-hmm. the boys are generally the ones that gets priority. And then something that we also often see is a parent can send, you know, both their children to school, but if they need help at home, it's the girls that stay at home to help.
Mm-hmm.
So it might not be, it's a day here, someone needs help getting water or fetching firewood, or you know, the mom has to go to the clinic with the kids. So the oldest stay home to cook, or, you know, whatever it is. And it's a day here, it's the day there. And then it kind of adds up. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the school year, these girls have missed so many days that they fail their exams.
Okay.
Whereas the boys, you know, they generally go to school every day. So that's a problem that we see. And that we have a lot of conversations with parents on, like the importance of sending your kids to school every day. And then another huge issue is when girls get their period. Mm-hmm. And many of them don't have access to sanitary pads. So they end up staying home. And again, they miss so many days every month. And, you know, they fall behind. And then they end up just dropping out of school.
To me, it sounds systemic. You know, it's systemic, and there's aspects of it that aren't so different from our own culture over time. You know, we're working on it, but
yeah.
Yeah. that women make the home and, you know, the whole thing and raise families and the whole thing. And so we end up not having the same opportunity because there's that expectation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, so you've told me a little bit about a couple of exceptional people in your organization. Could you maybe talk about it, one or two of them that you want to just give a little life example?
Absolutely. I have an amazing team in Uganda. I really, really enjoy working together with all of them. And a number, not all, but a number of the staff that we have started as actual members of a women's groups that we started working with. And the person that comes to mind first is Evelyn, who is now our program manager of the PermaGarden program. So Evelyn, and she's another example of someone having the lived experiences mm-hmm. of the people in our communities. Mm-hmm. She grew up in Northern Uganda. She stayed in a camp for internally displaced people during the conflict. And she was there for, I think maybe 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Like it was a long time. And she ended up joining one of African Women Rising's women's groups because she had a really hard time taking care of her family and feeding her children. So this was a microfinance group that then got into PermaGarden. And she was really, really good at doing this. And so when we needed to hire more community mobilizers, first we go to the women's groups that we're working with to see if there's any interest. And Evelyn got hired. And she started as a community mobilizer and slowly moved up. She was assistant program manager, senior program manager, and then, you know, she became the program manager. And throughout the time, we have helped her get her education. She got an associate's degree in agriculture. You know, we built her confidence along the way. But, you know, right now she's running the program and she has, I think, like 75 or 80 people that she's managing.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's just like, she is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. She just gave a presentation for, I think it was USAID the other day and just rocked it.
Wow. Yeah. I know I've seen you talk about these people that you've worked with all these years and you have so much pride. It's almost like family pride or something like that, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are people, some of them I worked with for, Patrick he's the one who's been with us the longest and he's been working for AWR for 16 years now.
Wow.
But a lot of the people in the senior management, they've been with the organization for, you know, 14, 15 years. And so, you know, wow. Of course they become family. And they were, I mean, today we have close to 350 staff. But it took a long time before we got there. So
all local,
you know, in the beginning.
To that, is it a village? Is it one particular village that's all local there?
No. So we work in three districts.
Okay.
So geographically, it's a pretty large area.
Mm.
And so we have staff from all the different districts. And then within the districts, there's sub-counties that we work with. And we also in... right towards the border of South Sudan, we work in a refugee camp, in Palabek refugee camp, where our farm is.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I want to, okay, so, I mean, that's so, number one, brilliant, such a model for others, you know, this idea of developing what you need from within, with leadership from within, them knowing what they need. There's so much to it that is brilliant. And yet, the patience, the persistence, the consistency. I mean, you lived there when you started it, but you have since raised a family in Santa Barbara with you and your husband trading places, I think pretty much, don't you? You know, quarterly you guys go, and
yeah,
it's just insane to me. I love it.
Yeah. So initially, Ali and Tobias, my kids, were living in Uganda. And then we got to a point where I had a team together in Uganda that were running all of the programs, and we were struggling with funding. And at the same time, we were experiencing some family issues in Santa Barbara. So it was a good time for us to move back, where I could focus more on the fundraising part. So it was a good timing for us.
Okay. So that's when you made that move.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to say that my experience is the efficacy of your fundraising. Like every dollar that is donated has such a high ratio of utilization within the organization. You guys run a lean, mean, powerful machine, really.
Yeah, and that's been, you know, the goal the whole time, that the office here in the U.S. is very small.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's me here. And I have a couple people help me part-time. But then, you know, the majority of stuff happens in Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we have our big office. That's where, you know, all the staff are, so...
Yeah.
So that's always been really important to me too, that to try and be as effective as possible mm-hmm. with the funding that we get. Like, you know, we could have an office in Kampala. People always ask me, why don't you have an office in Kampala? It's like, we don't do work there.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the capital of Uganda.
City. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. And so, yeah. You know, why should we? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned this adult literacy center, and can you tell us just a little bit more about what happens there?
Mm-hmm. So African Women Rising is the largest provider of adult literacy in northern Uganda. And the centers that we have, they're so much more than a place where people learn how to read and write. They're really these vibrant community centers where we use participatory methods to help people identify issues that they have in their communities and then come up with a solution to resolve it. So it could be, for example, the primary school is really far away, so young children cannot walk there. So parents may come together and start a school for, you know, the younger kids, or in many communities, it has to do with bridges that are not there. So the community will come together, build a bridge because the stream floods, whatever it rains. Water points is a huge issue that some of these groups focus on, where they might have an open well that they collect drinking water from. And if it rains or if animals comes close to it, it gets polluted. So
or something.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So groups have worked on, you know, building protections around wells. So there's this whole range of things that these adult literacy centers have done that is far beyond, you know, just learning how to read and write. And it's really about understanding or seeing that, yes, I can take charge of the issues in my community, and together we can do it and we can resolve this.
So it's like community organizing.
Mm-hmm.
That you're teaching.
Absolutely.
That model. Now, am I right or am I wrong when I say that you were really involved in the Bucket Brigade when our community had first fires and then a huge debris flow that took a bunch of lives in the community? And the Bucket Brigade, was that you?
Yes. So there were five of us that were the founders. So I was one of the founders. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was, to me, I spent so much of my life working in disaster areas or, you know, with humanitarian assistance. So it was just natural. Like, my community is in need and I have these skills that I can use. So of course, like, that was, yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. And what I want to just comment is the universally felt heart opening that that process of working together brought for the community in this horrible situation, that it actually in so many ways brought everyone together. So that was,
Absolutely. Yeah. It was people needed to feel connected, and the Bucket Brigade gave that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you know, we helped a lot of people that were completely at a loss. So,
right. Yeah. Wow. So you're showing people how to get things done.
Well,
okay. I want to hear a little bit more about what microfinance looks like, what permagardens are, briefly. Mm-hmm. Tom and Warren were on this show earlier and we touched on something, but I would love it if you would just describe that a little and why you brought those two pieces in and then lead into what that demonstration training garden is.
Mm-hmm. So all of our programs are based upon what the women in these communities identified as most important to them. Mm-hmm. And the number one thing that came up was access to capital. Like, it's really hard to do anything. Like, it doesn't matter if you're in Uganda or Santa Barbara or wherever you are. If you don't have access to capital, it's hard to move forward. Mm-hmm. And so that was a major stumbling block for many of these people. So we looked at what they already had in place, which is called revolving funds, where, you know, you're a group of people that come together and every week or every month you'll save a small amount of money and one person in your group will get this. So you kind of get a little push, a little help to move forward, right? So that's great. I mean, it's all over the world, you have variations of these revolving funds as a way that poor people can save money. But it means if you're in a group with 20 people, someone in your group gets money once a month. That means you have to wait 20 months for your turn. So we took this idea of the revolving funds, and there are already a lot of people who've done some smart thinking on this, and they've developed something that's called Village Savings and Loans Association. So we took that methodology and started teaching it to groups out in the communities. So it's basically helping groups of people to become their own bank system. So they save money every week, and
each person,
then they can, yes, each every
individual.
Person.
So if, I see.
Yes. Yeah. And put it into a little box, and then the members of the group can borrow from this box. So to speed that up a little bit, we provide the groups with a grant so they have starting capital. Mm. So now, instead of having to wait for, you know, 20 months to get money, everyone can start borrowing. And then they pay the money they borrow back to the group. And at the end of the year, the money that they've saved, they get back with an interest.
Wow.
So it's like, it's a whole little banking system. But so what we help with is, like, how do you keep track of all of this? And especially if you are in a group where most people don't know how to read or write. Mm-hmm. So we help with the tracking systems. We have community mobilizers who come in and support the groups. We also look at, okay, so now you have this money, what are you gonna do with it? How do you start a business? So we build basic business skills.
Okay.
And it's been extremely effective.
So really each household, is the goal is to build, teach them how to build a savings account to build toward more. And is that method through the garden, or what's their method for earning or making money?
Oh, there's a variety of ways, but the majority of people, their main income comes from farming.
Okay.
So our next step then was looking at how do you increase production. So now you have a little bit of money and you can invest in your farming. But so the agriculture programs that we have, one is the field crop program and one is the permagarden program. It looks at what kind of methods can you use to increase your productivity. And so it's looking a lot at soil fertility and water retention, and also just growing crops in a time when the weather is not as dependable as it used to be. And so the weather patterns are changing more. You know, there's more drought, there's more flooding. And how do you grow successfully within that?
So you're giving them, let's say, what I am thinking of is regenerative farming methods. Like you're teaching them some of those. And it's not simple is what I'm finding, you know. And it's like you need to know these tools and these skills, especially I could imagine in that area. And that's where Tom's expertise kind of comes in. And he doesn't, he came from a whole permaculture garden.
So he has, so he has always been helping with the agricultural part and supporting the agricultural staff in AWR. And so, for example, when we started, our focus was on field crop. So people have access to maybe 1 or 2 acres of land where they can grow food. But we had women coming to us saying, look, we have our fields, but we still experience hunger periods. And so a hunger period is when all the food that you've grown in your field runs out and you're still waiting for the next harvest to come.
Right.
And so you cut down on food consumption. So it could be maybe you eat once a day or you eat every other day. And, you know, this sometimes it's a couple of weeks, sometimes a month, you know, depending on when you can harvest again. So the whole permagarden concept came out of that, like, how can we supplement the field crop production and have a garden that produces all year round?
So sort of close the gap of nutrition for these people so that they can keep strong.
And so the permagarden is basically a small kitchen garden where you grow food very intensively, and you can grow a lot of food on a very small piece of land.
With this method.
So for someone who's elderly and doesn't have the strength to work in a field, you know, the permagarden is a good substitution. Or if you live in a refugee camp and you don't have access to land, you know, the permagarden works very well.
That, to me, leads us into your latest project that I heard about 2 years ago, I think, and I got really excited about. And would you tell us a little bit about that? I think of it as the demonstration and training garden, but what do you call it? And tell us a little bit about what that is.
Kind of what we call it too. But now we have an actual name for it, and it's called Loch Neno. And it's a name that our staff came up with, and it means let's change our mindset.
I love that. Wow.
Yes, me too. Yeah.
Loch Neno, did I say it right? Loch Neno?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So the farm, we started it, 2 years ago now?
Feels like it.
And yeah. So we've been working in Palabek refugee camp since 2017. And the camp is run by the United Nations and the Office of the Prime Minister in Uganda. OPM has kept pushing us to construct a permanent office in the refugee camp. And for various number of reasons, that doesn't necessarily make sense to us because we have so much work that is outside of the camp. So I kept saying, look, we're not going to do that. But if you give us land, we'll start a farm. And I thought that's never going to happen. And then they ended up giving us like 12, 13 acres of land. Wow. So I was like, okay, what are we doing now?
You weren't even playing hard to get. It just had.
Yeah. And luckily I have Tom and Warren Brush who are, you know, they know about this kind of work. So doing it to them has with them has been fantastic. So we so the whole idea with the farm is we have this amazing methodology that we have seen has been very successful, especially in humanitarian situations. The permagardens work, you know, both in humanitarian situations and also in the communities where we're working.
Right.
That's the initial start for the permagarden methodology, and it was developed in the communities of northern Uganda.
Right.
And then it just happened to work really well a refugee situation.
Right.
So we kept getting requests to increase our work. Like we work in Palabek refugee camp. There's 80,000 people there, but there's close to 1.5 million refugees in northern Uganda. So our, you know, we don't have the capacity to reach everyone. So the goal with Lokneno is that it's a training of trainers program. Uh-huh. So we bring in organizations from all over East Africa. They come to spend 2 weeks at the farm and they learn how to do this methodology.
Wow. So it's that same idea of growing it from within, like you're building capacity in an exponential way by training trainers so that it just goes out. It's like teaching the people to fish, you would say, and taking
their
region. But is there a necessity that they be Ugandan? Like you were given this land. Is there any criteria for who can come and learn? Or is it only Ugandans or who comes?
So we've had people from all over East Africa. Okay. We had the first training in November last year, and there were people from Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, of course, Sudan, South Sudan. We had a couple of people from the U.S.
Okay.
We had a woman from NASA.
What?
It's an amazing group of people.
They're going to use this on the moon. So the word is out. The word is out.
Absolutely. Okay. And we have our next training is coming up in end of February, and it's basically sold out. We have another training later in the fall, and we have a waiting list. So there's a huge need for this kind of training and knowledge. You know, hopefully they'll take this knowledge and they'll go back to the programs that they're running, and it will provide people that are living in crisis situations, if it's war, you know, land degradation, or you know, climate disaster, they can use this and hopefully still produce food.
I've seen slides of what is accomplished in these permagardens that I understand Tom wrote a curriculum for USAID. So now it's available through USAID for other people to use, but somehow he's perfected this methodology that allows refugees or whoever to produce food within 10 days, I recall, because these NGOs or the aid ends up being such a small amount of food that they're given when they cross this border with nothing. And within a very short period of time, with this training and knowledge, they're able to actually start cultivating food.
Yes. So once you have your permagarden in place, people can generally start harvesting greens within 10 days.
Wow.
And the food that people get in these camps, it's all, you know, dried. It's dried beans, It's dried mace. They get a little bit of cooking oil, tiny bit of salt, but there's no, you know, there's no vegetables. There's no fresh food.
Right.
So the gardens really provide an important source of this nutrition.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, it's inspiring to see, and I'm so excited about it because I think the world, I mean, is headed toward a place of more and more refugees. And that empowerment that you're offering is so just, it lifts my heart. It makes me so happy every time I hear about this project. But where are you now? Like, what have you built and what have you yet to build? Or where is this Loc Nenos? Where are you at with completing that? And are you done? Or tell me, is there any plan to go beyond that?
So we're still in the process of developing the farm. We built a classroom.
Okay.
Which is great. We have a kitchen that's under construction. We're building some accommodation because right now there's no place for our program participants to stay at the farm.
Uh-huh.
So they have to go to the nearest town and it takes like an hour and a half.
Right.
So every day they, you know, spend 3 hours on really bad roads. So we're looking at building accommodation.
Okay.
But we've started, we've done a lot of work on planting out the land.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a natural pond that we've dug out that is almost full with water.
Planting the rain. Isn't that what Warren calls it? Warren and Tom.
Absolutely. Like
you
yes.
create these earth structures that when it rains, which it does, I think, in large amounts infrequently there, it just captures the rain.
There's two main rainy seasons. And so you want to make sure that you plant your crops or your trees with the rain when the rain starts.
Okay.
Just to give them a chance to get established and grow. So when the dry season comes, they have deep roots and can get access to water.
Right. So it holds it there. Yeah. These are still principles that I'm learning and trying to enact at my ranch as well. So it's thrilling to me. I remember not too long ago seeing a presentation of some of the results and where you guys are at right now. And it's been wildly successful. And from what I heard, it sounds like you're not just the staff, but the participants. You have such a deep well of knowledge in the participants with African Women Rising, and that's who's running it and actually bringing these bigger, larger, deeper dimensions to this demonstration garden. So it's like one thing is feeding on another, from what I think I understand. Is that right?
Yes. So Warren and Tom leads the training, but then there's a number of our staff that are helping with the training to lead the training. And some of the practical learning that has been taking place has been within the refugee camp and within the communities that are there, so that they can actually come to someone's home and look at the whole compound. So each refugee gets a piece of land that's 90 by 90 feet.
Okay.
And so the permagarden is, we look at the whole site, like how to best design it so that you use the space most effectively. So there's a permagarden, but there's also, you know, we're planting trees. We're making sure that the house is built in a place where it doesn't get flooded. Huh. And, you know, 90 by 90 feet, it's not a lot. So you want to make sure that you use it as effectively as possible.
But you're giving them the core principles, and then they get to go see how the folks have actually enacted it in their homes, which is so brilliant.
Absolutely.
And I think Tom's going to come out to the ranch and he's going to help me apply some of those principles to my vegetable garden, which I can't wait. So, but okay, something that I just have to say that touched me so deeply when I was looking at the slides and just amazed at the duration and the dedication and the care, the love and the community you've built. But one of the most astounding things is when Tom sent through a photograph of a beautiful woman and then a photograph of a child. And it said, just one of the millions, or not millions, but the many Linda Coles in Uganda. Can you tell me how many Linda Coles do you think there are in Uganda right now in your area?
Oh, I would say maybe 170, 180.
Oh my God. You know,
something like that. Yeah.
That says it all to me. I mean, who you
It's an amazing honor. Absolutely. Yeah.
Gosh. And it just so well deserved, because like you come from such a place of integrity and deep, deep care. And to me, I mean, the focus of this show is regenerative practices. And if this isn't sort of the pinnacle of that, like the idea of giving more than you take, I just, you're one of my heroes for sure.
Oh, so, you're making me blush here.
Well, good, because you should be. So as we're getting close to wrapping here, I'm just curious to know, like, how we can help support African Women Rising. What are the best ways for us to support?
All right. Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is donating. Mm-hmm. That the only thing that is keeping us back is lack of access to funding.
Okay.
So when... You know, I've just been working with my team on the budget for 2024, and I keep telling them, no, sorry, you have to slow down because we have to raise more money before we can do more. So that's our biggest obstacle. But then, you know, it's things like this is immensely supportive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the easiest way, of course, is donating, but then, you know, send me an email and we can talk.
Yeah.
To see what you want to do. Yeah.
And are there ways for us to apply? I mean, do you see us being able to apply your mindset? I mean, I love this. Let's change our mindset. The motto of Lok Neno. Yeah. How do we change our mindset?
You know, there's so many different ways we can change our mindset. I mean, what we're talking about at Lok Neno is here are new ways to implement farming. And here's new way about thinking about how we treat the earth. And, you know, it really comes down to me, like if we look at it big picture, is if we're kind to the earth gives back to us, mm-hmm. right? If we abuse it, if we don't give back, eventually it's going to tell us, no, this is enough. So, and that kind of goes into everything in life, right? If you're kind to people, they'll be kind back to you.
Gosh, here we go again. And you're making me cry again. You do this every time. I find it's so simple, yet.
It really is simple. We make it way too complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. And keeping that mindset and just continuing to deepen it and make it. I mean, look what you created. You've created something so impactful to so many. So anyway.
And I've had a lot of help. So it's not just me on my own. Yeah.
And that's the brilliance of it, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming and telling us about it. It always makes my heart feel so hopeful. It really does. I mean, this is where hope comes in.
Well, that's always been my intention with African Women Rising, that people will come to the organization and feel hope, not despair.
Yeah.
And so if you look at our website, if you look at, you know, emails that we send out, there's no kids with big bellies and flies, mm-hmm. and there's no women looking for handouts. I mean, we're working with strong, capable people who have a very clear understanding of what they need. Mm-hmm. And I want people to be part of African Women Rising because they feel like this is good. This mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. energizing. Mm-hmm. This makes me happy. Mm-hmm. So when you say that, that makes me glad.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. So you've integrated the whole thing about dignity and, mm-hmm. you know, uplifting. And when we're all together, I mean, they have the disadvantage of having been exposed to war. And yeah, that's nobody's fault. So,
no.
Oh, brilliant and beautiful. Well, thank you for being here, and we'll look forward to hearing more from you. That's a wrap for today's episode of Regenerative Spaces. If you found this episode valuable or thought-provoking, share it with a friend and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'll keep the conversation going over on Instagram, so join me at Stacy Pellice and share your thoughts, questions, or suggestions for future episodes. I love hearing from you. And before we go, your support means the world to me. If you have a moment, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help us reach even more people looking to spark sustainable change in our world. Stay curious, stay inspired, and until next time, this is Stacy Pellice, and you've been listening to Regenerative Spaces.